Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. You know what can totally ruin my day when I'm outside walking around having a nice time and then I'm hearing this? Oh, God, don't do it. It's just so disgusting. It makes me feel like I'm never going to be able to eat again. Do you feel nauseous too? I'm sorry. I get grossed out pretty easily, but I'm also weirdly fascinated by the concept of disgust. So I recently asked people online what grosses them out. Spitting did rank high, clipping fingernails, and yes, toenails, that's apparently a thing, in public, nose picking, hot air coming out of subway grates, people chewing with their mouths open. There were also some weird ones like grease on the inside windows of public transportation vehicles, wet doorknobs, damp towels. But gross things are also often a great place for scientific investigation if you can get over your weak stomach. For example, I remember talking to a dermatologist who treats toenail fungus for a living and warts.
No.
So I got pretty much queasy just looking at some of the pictures in her lab, but she acted like she had won the game of life.
I don't think it's yuck. I think it's fantastic. I love treating fungus and warts.
On today's show, we'll explore yucky things and what researchers are learning about them, how fly spit messes up crime scenes, why parasitic worms could become our friends, and whether bar soap is gross. I think bar soap is fine unless it has a hair stuck on it. Before we get into all of those lovely things, though, I want to explore why we feel disgust. And this is David Pizarro's specialty. He is a psychologist at Cornell University. And one of the reasons he was drawn to this emotion as a researcher is this.
Disgust is one of the easiest emotions to manipulate in the lab.
With other emotions, let's say happiness, sadness, or anger, it's tough to get people to feel those things on the spot. You can ask them to write about a time when they were happy, or maybe you can show them a sad film clip.
You can kind of make them feel an emotion. They'll tell you that they feel slightly happier if they've done this, or slightly sadder if they watch a sad clip of a movie. Disgust, all you need is a picture.
He uses pictures of knee surgery, vomit, feces, and you also use fart spray, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right. It's an odor, you know, because of the role that disgust plays, the reason we think disgust exists is to keep us away from things that might hurt us, especially poisons and pathogens or disease, germs. And so because smell is such a good cue that something should not be eaten, it turns out that it's one of the easiest ways to induce disgust. So if you look across cultures, there are a lot of things that pretty much disgust most people, things like bodily fluids, feces and urine, things like putrid meat. All of these things were things that ought to be avoided because they could transmit disease. And it's a very interesting thing that we have an emotion that responds to those things even before we had a theory of how disease gets transmitted.
And where do we feel it? You know, we get kind of nauseous. I mean, where in the body do we register disgust?
Yeah, so revulsion is a common description, nausea. In fact, if I were to show you a picture that's very, very disgusting, your tongue would move slightly in the direction of trying to remove something from your mouth, even though you don't notice it. That's kind of a reflexive reaction. And so people often refer to it as very visceral emotion, because one of the things that disgust ought to do is if you've ingested something that's gross, maybe you need to throw it up.
Disgust is also individual. For example, I have a thing that I get very disgusted when people hock a loogie on the street.
So that's right.
That just grosses me out.
There are wide individual differences and there are cultural differences. So we might all in the United States think that spitting on the street is pretty disgusting. You might actually just be more easily disgusted than some people. I also find the minute you said that, I felt some disgust myself because I'm pretty sensitive to disgust. But, you know, there are cultures in which spitting is not viewed as that disgusting. And I think that's an important point to make.
But we can also learn to get over our disgust, right? So let's say, you know, I clean up vomit for a living somehow. The first time, not a good job. Yes. No. Why did you have to do that? So let's say that's my job. I'm sure the first day is going to be terrible. Maybe the second day gets better. And then eventually I'm just going to be like, oh, yeah, you know.
Absolutely. We do have this ability to get over disgust. Now, what we see is that we can adapt to certain kinds of stimuli. Like if you have to pick up poop, after a while, picking up poop won't disgust you as much. But a strange and foreign food might disgust you just as much. So it's not that your overall disgust sensitivity goes down across the board. It's that as human beings, we can easily adapt to specific things pretty easily.
How does my or the sensation of disgust influence other thoughts or emotions that I have? So let's say I meet a person and that person smells bad. How will that impact what I think of that person?
It's a powerful emotion in that sense. So as I said before, disgust seems to be an emotion that evolved to protect you against disease. Now, one of the biggest sources of disease is other human beings. Right? So whenever you have another human being who gives off certain cues that could be odor, as you say, or personal hygiene habits, very, very easy to feel that feeling of disgust. The motivation of disgust, say with your, not to keep bringing up the loogie example, but you feel strong desire to avoid the loogie. But guess what? You also feel a desire to avoid the person. You've now tagged the person themselves with disgust.
So I'm hating the spitter as much as I hate the loogie itself.
Yeah, and I don't know that I would even use the word hate. It's less involved even than hate. Hate, I think, is more angry. Right? And anger is actually an emotion that engages with the other person. You want to yell at that person. You want to come in contact with them and tell them that you are upset with what they've done. Disgust is a colder emotion. It pushes the other person away.
David Pizarro is a professor of psychology at Cornell University, and he just said disgust can push us away. But stay with me. Think about it. So much of what we find repulsive is not really harmful to us. So let's get past these sentiments and take a closer look at what we can learn from things that may seem gross at first. For example, worms. A wiggling heap of worms. That's already pretty gross. But worse than that, parasitic freeloading worms living off your body. I've lately become kind of reluctant to eat sushi because I read online that some raw salmon might have tapeworm larvae inside of it. And the thought of that just totally freaks me out. It tops my love of sushi even. But there are some researchers who say parasitic worms could one day help cure disease. Here's reporter Alan Yu with more.
Around 10 years ago, Jim Turk was going to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison while working full-time. He ran marathons, and he was a drummer in the band. But his life changed dramatically in 2008.
I could only run for maybe a minute or two before shaking uncontrollably, not able to turn off my iPod, losing control of my bladder.
After several doctor's visits, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, or MS. That's a disease where the material protecting nerve cells is damaged. Not long after that, Jim heard about an unusual clinical trial at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which would involve him gulping down live worm eggs.
People think it's swallowing earthworms.
But really, Jim just drank a small paper cup of mildly salty water with microscopic worm eggs inside. He had worked in science labs, so he didn't find it too gross to have worms living inside him.
But I also knew that it'd be really tough to get people to sign up for the study.
During the three-month trial, Jim did a lot of tests, everything from math problems and walking to MRI scans. The trial was run by John Fleming, a neurologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says we live in a very clean world, free from a lot of parasites, and sometimes that can be a bad thing. The immune system can turn on your own body.
We think that's the basis of autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis. For some reason, the immune system attacks the person's own tissues. In the case of multiple sclerosis, the brain and spinal cord.
If that hypothesis is true, then maybe adding some parasites back would reset the immune system, like rebooting a computer. So Fleming says Jim Turk and four other patients swallowed the eggs, and then?
Within about 24 hours, the eggs hatch to little teeny microscopic worms. And these grow over the course of a couple weeks in the gastrointestinal system, in the colon, to about the size of an eyelash.
So picture a clear, wiggling eyelash.
They sit just on the surface of the lining of the colon. And we know it stimulates the cells of the colon and probably from there into the whole immune system.
These are pig whipworms. They're not human parasites, so they can't live inside humans for too long. That means the patients in this trial had to swallow more eggs every 2 weeks to keep the mild infection going. Fleming says he had high hopes after one observational study in Argentina.
When patients got a parasite, their multiple sclerosis was virtually cured.
The clinical trials in Wisconsin were not that effective. The latest one studied 16 patients for 10 months. The results haven't been published yet, but John Fleming says patients who got the worm eggs had 35% less brain lesions, or markers where the disease is active.
That's a modest effect. It's certainly not a cure for multiple sclerosis at this point.
Again, this study used pig parasites, and he says the next step in this research might be using human parasites. Other ongoing studies already do this, but not everyone is on board. Here's Thomas Leist. He's a neurologist and MS specialist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals in Philadelphia.
Outside of clinical studies where we actually purposefully infect people with some eggs of worms or worm infections, I don't think so.
He says using parasites could have unintended consequences, like giving patients an infection somewhere else by mistake. Rather than making a worm treatment, Leist says researchers will probably study how our immune system reacts to these worms and see if there's anything we might learn that could be used to develop something else to treat MS. Meanwhile, worm research is still going on. For example, doctors in New Zealand are going to give parasitic hookworms to patients with celiac disease. This comes after a similar study in Australia, where patients with celiac disease got hookworms and managed to eat a bowl of spaghetti without the expected reaction of diarrhea, cramps, and throwing up. Jim Turk, the patient in the Wisconsin trial, now does a lot of public speaking about having MS, and he says the worm story is a perfect hook.
It was a great way to get people's attention fast because, again, they have this picture in their head and they think it sounds gross at first.
Jim wants to get people interested in participating in clinical trials, even if it involves something that might gross them out. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
All right, Alan, I still think parasitic worms are disgusting, but I could see how people would change their minds if there is a medical reason. And something similar happened to one of our Pulse contributors, who is also a doctor.
I'm Netta Freja. I'm an internist in Baltimore, and when I was in medical school, my friends and I were totally grossed out by teratomas. A teratoma is a kind of tumor that contains lots of different kinds of tissues and body parts inside of it. So imagine things like teeth and bone and hair and fat and sometimes like thyroid tissue all in one clump of cells. Fast forward a couple of years, and during a routine visit with my gynecologist, she felt something that wasn't totally normal. She ordered some imaging tests, and sure enough, I had a teratoma on my ovary. I couldn't believe it. All those years of being grossed out by this one kind of tumor, and I happened to have it. Now, fortunately, teratomas are usually benign, but they can cause some serious complications. So I needed to have surgery. Everything went fine. My gynecologist took it out. It was about 2 centimeters in size, so not terribly huge. And now that it's all over, somehow, I don't hate teratomas quite as much as I used to. They are still really gross, but at least they're not evil. And for that, I am very grateful.
Thank you, Netta, for that. And here's a little tip. Do not Google teratoma. Just don't. It's so disgusting. The images are so gross. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott, and our show today is about yucky stuff. But don't go anywhere. There's some awesome science to be found around things that may seem gross at first. What do you think of earwax? Probably not your favorite thing, correct? But it serves a really important function, and being disgusted by it drives some people toward an unhealthy obsession with cleaning it out. Here's reporter Max Green with more.
The yellowish, sticky secretion traps microscopic bits of dust and other particles to help protect the eardrum from the outside world. It helps fight off bad bacteria, and without it, our ears would be more vulnerable to damage or infection. I've never really minded talking about my earwax, but the subject can trigger revulsion for some. So, for science, I asked people on the street about their earwax. They had a lot of questions.
What's the appropriate way to clean it out of your ear?
Why do some people have more of it than others?
I have no idea what it's for.
Why it has its color.
What's the right amount of earwax to have in your ear?
What's safe Q-tip use?
At what point should I start taking
it out?
I
don't know anything about it.
I'm not sure.
So what is it?
Where does it come from?
Let's start with the basics from Dr. Fuad Baroudi, an ear, nose, and throat specialist at the University of Chicago Medicine. He says he gets a lot of questions about earwax.
It's a useful thing. If wax is not bothersome, your ears are fine.
Glands in your ear produce earwax, and as you chew or move your jaw, it very slowly moves from deep in the ear canal to the outer ear and eventually falls away. That's about it. But should we be trying to manage what's going on in our ears?
You shouldn't be messing with them. Let them clear themselves out.
Baroudi says if you think earwax is clogging your ears or your ears itch or the wax smells funny, maybe get it checked out. And that's also the official stance of the American Academy of Otolaryngology. Those are the ear, nose, and throat specialists. The doctor's group published updated earwax guidelines this year. The physicians say unless you have a serious condition, like an ear infection or hearing loss, the best thing you can do with earwax is leave it alone. Even using a tiny Q-tip or other tools can cause problems.
There are two things. There's a disadvantage and there's potential danger. Disadvantage is you sometimes push the wax further in and cause it to impact, and then it really becomes harder to clean, and it has to be done by a professional.
And the potential danger? Injuring your ear canal. Rupturing an eardrum is easier than you might think. Dr. Baroudi says people shove all kinds of things in their ears to try to clean them.
Pencil erasers are a favorite. Lead of the pencil, the inside of the lead of the pencil, pieces of paper, people push things in their ears.
Other people go further, turning to alternative methods. You can buy mini vacuums online to suck the stuff out, or some people do candling. That's a treatment that uses the heat from a hollow candle to draw wax out of the ear. Baroudi has seen a few burnt eardrums in his day. He does not recommend this kind of thing. So what does the ear doctor do?
I never clean my ears. After shower, I put my finger on a towel, and I make sure that the water gets out of my ear, and I'm done.
The expert leaves his alone, but most people I spoke with said they couldn't imagine not cleaning out their earwax.
It's gross.
It's frustrating.
It's really disgusting.
It's really gross.
It's unsightly.
I just can't have it in my ear.
Clean your ears.
Gross.
I want that wax out of my ear, man.
You need to clean it.
Unhygienic.
There's something in there that needs to come out.
Almost everyone knew about the strong recommendation against using cotton swabs for ear cleaning. The warning is right there on the Q-tip box. But people do it anyway. Try doing it now. Stick your finger in there and circle it around a little. There is a tingle, a sensation, right? Cleaning your ears just feels good to some people. And Baroudi says we can develop all kinds of compulsive behavior with sensations like that. For some small number of us, there's a kind of body horror fascination. Studying the brown glob on the end of that cotton swab is probably like looking at the tissue after you blow your nose. Lots of us do it. It can be hard to kick weird habits. Baroudi sees earwax all the time, so maybe he's a little desensitized. But he says the stuff in your ear is just doing its job.
You can quote an ear doctor saying that it's not dirty. Wax is not like other things that come out of body orifices.
So there. Technically, not gross.
It's so handy having Q-tips round the house.
For The Pulse,
you
I'm Max Green.
You can do so much with Q-tips round the house. Your pets deserve loving.
You. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Megan Scott. Our show today is basically the joy of yuck. Scientists so often seem thrilled with things that gross most of us out. Take a listen to biologist Karen Bondar describing praying mantis sex.
It often actually makes sense for a male to impregnate a female with his sperm and then keep her busy for a while so she's not out there selecting other mates. So his sperm has a greater chance to reach her eggs. Now, just how can he keep her busy? Well, she's eating his body. That takes a little bit of time. And so there is actually, I know, I kid you not, there is a lot of evidence, and especially in praying mantids, the male's body actually keeps having sex with the female after she's ripped his head off. It's kind of like a chicken running around with his head cut off, except that it's a praying mantid that's continuing to have sex with his female partner, even though he doesn't have a head.
Gross and fascinating things on The Pulse today. That was biologist Karen Bondar. She has a book called Wild Sex, The Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom. All right, let's move on to farts. That's a line I'll never get to say again. We heard from a scientist earlier who uses fart spray, basically sulfur smell in a bottle, to gross out his subjects in a lab. Flatulence is one of those disgust triggers that's pretty universal, even though we all do it. Dan Knights studies why we fart. All right, he studies a lot more than that. He is a microbiologist and a computer scientist, but I did call him up to talk about gas, which is funny to me, but I failed miserably trying to make him laugh. Does anybody in your lab have any good fart jokes?
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing about working in this area is that we've gotten very comfortable talking about poop.
Oh, scientists, always so serious. But as I talk to him more, it turns out farts are a very serious topic. So let me ask you, Dan, why do we fart?
When you're digesting food, a lot of the digestion is not actually done by your own body. It's done by your microbes. And there are many different types of molecules that the microbes break down for you. And when they do that, they produce various gases, and those gases come out as farts.
So I have a whole army in my stomach basically working away at my food.
That's right. A typical healthy person has at least several hundred different species of microbes, and each of them is basically a little chemical factory that takes certain nutrients from your diet and converts them into other chemicals and gases. And then they pass them around to each other and convert them again. And that process can go on for quite a while.
And are there certain foods that produce more gas, less gas?
There are. The different types of foods that you eat produce different types of gas when they're broken down by microbes. So, for example, some foods produce hydrogen sulfide, which has that kind of sulfury rotten egg smell.
Which are the worst foods in terms of stinky gas?
Probably depends to some extent on which microbes you have in your gut, because not everybody has the same microbes. In fact, your microbes are even more unique to you than your fingerprint or your own DNA. Even if you pick two people from the same country living in the same city, they might have only 30 or 40% of the species in their gut in common. So those microbes have different capabilities for breaking down different types of food and producing different types of gases.
How do you study what's inside of us, the microbiome? How do you get your samples?
Well, we've got to get the gut microbes out of you somehow. So the most natural way to do that is with a stool sample.
And you need just a tiny sample, right?
We need a tiny, tiny sample. I mean, it's the consequence of how tiny these microbes are that basically an amount of sample the size of a grain of rice is enough to understand the entire ecosystem that would be present in a stool. And then we basically grind up all of the DNA that's there and sequence it on a DNA sequencing machine the same way we would if we wanted to sequence your own human genome. And then what we get back is a massive set of millions of DNA sequences. And then it's like a big jigsaw puzzle where we're trying to reassemble them and determine what species you have, what types of behaviors they can do, and which ones are good and which ones are bad.
To bring us back to farts once more, would there be any benefit in studying the gas that we put out?
That's a really interesting question. And yes, actually, we do that. There are certain types of measurements we make of all of the different gases and chemicals that are produced by the bacteria. And those can help us to better understand what the bacteria are actually doing inside you.
Dan Knights is a microbiologist with the University of Minnesota, giving us a whole lot of facts about flatulence. I didn't know it takes a whole army to make one single fart. But I did have one lingering question. Why and how do farts make noise? Science reporter Sandon Totten can answer that. He dug into this burning question for the kids' podcast, Brains On.
Basically, the noise factor has to do with three things. First, volume, or the amount of gas you pass. Second, the force, or how strong that gas is pushed out. And third, the size of the hole the gas rushes through. And that hole, of course, is the one we expel waste from. Yes, the hole in our rumps. More on that in a moment. Notice I didn't mention the cheeks of the derriere. A lot of people blame those, but in reality, they have very little to do with the noises that we make. That whoopee cushion sound comes from the end of the digestive tract, that opening in your rear end we mentioned earlier. When a lot of gas is pushed out that tiny opening in short order, it vibrates the tissue. Now, vibrations create sound waves. So in this case, when the opening of your bum vibrates, it goes... Now, to explain, I enlisted some help from a tuba. Because farting isn't that different from playing a brass instrument. Let me demonstrate. To make a sound, you have to press your lips tightly together and blow air through the opening of the instrument. Tuba. Now, when you blow the same amount of air through the opening with super tight lips, it sounds like... Of course, sometimes we just pass a little gas. So what does it sound like when you squeeze just a little air through tightly pressed lips? Sometimes we try to let that gas out slowly, and that sounds kind of like... Other times, we decide to push it all out fast just to speed things up. But if we break wind when we're more relaxed, it's like the sound a tuba player makes when his lips are more relaxed. And if you let one rip when you're really relaxed, pretty much silent.
That's Sandon Totten. He originally produced this piece for the kids' podcast, Brains On. Coming up, a conversation with a forensic entomologist who studies bugs on dead bodies.
Sometimes you can actually grind up the fly maggots and detect gunshot residue actually in the body.
I wish you could see my face right now.
So is this fitting the bill of disgusting then?
I would say so. That's still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about yucky science. So far, we've heard from scientists studying parasitic worms, earwax, farts, and it seems like it takes a lot to gross out a scientist, but sometimes it does happen, just like with the rest of us. Here's biologist Matt Coleman.
I do remember being on a boat, and we were long lining for sharks, and we had a tiger shark show up on deck, and almost immediately it got up on deck and just vomited basically seabird feet all over the deck because They're one of the few sharks that's really known to eat birds. And so that was pretty gross because really all we saw was just the bills, the feathers, and then the feet.
Matt works on San Juan Island at the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Labs. And how about this? Here's Jason Poole. He's a paleontologist at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. He says when he's out in the field, he often encounters scorpions and ticks or spiders, and that's fine. But he cannot take slugs, grubs, and leeches.
One summer when I was about 12 or 13, I stepped on a slug, one of the big ones that you see in the sidewalk sometimes. It squished between my toes, and I felt like I couldn't wash off the slug innards and slime. It was really gross. About a week later, I stepped on a huge grub. It popped and gushed between my toes, and I threw up just a little bit. In fact, my toes are all bunched up as I say this, and for the leeches, leeches really are just gross.
Blah. I'm with you on the slugs, Jason, but nothing on this planet grosses out Dave Rivers. He's a professor of biology at Loyola University, Maryland. He's a forensic entomologist. That means he spends his time looking at insects on and around dead bodies. Are you a favorite guest at dinner parties or the least favorite guest at dinner parties?
Well, you know, that kind of is a mixed bag. So if I introduce myself and someone says, what do you do? And if I say an entomologist, you can feel that hand starting to slip back out of theirs as that this conversation should end. But then if you throw in that you study insects on dead things, then they are all ears. It's the craziest thing. People are repulsed by insects, but they are fascinated by death and the macabre. And so they want to hear more.
Insects and bugs are also drawn to death, or rather, dead bodies. They smell them and seek them out as a food source. And Rivers looks at what's crawling around at a crime scene for clues.
If you really have a good understanding of the insects and who should be here and when should they be here in terms of location, then you can actually determine, has that body been moved? In some cases, you can actually use insects as surrogates for human tissue. So if a body is really badly decomposed, but you suspect that, say, that this person has been shot, then sometimes you can actually grind up the fly maggots and detect gunshot residue actually in their body.
So flies can help solve a crime, but they can also really contaminate a crime scene because of the way they eat.
Well, they're very sloppy. So they remind me of my teenage sons. If you have a body that there are body fluids that actually have been released, and that's fairly common, regardless of whether that you've actually had some type of blunt force trauma, they're going to walk through their food first. So if you have existing blood stains that show directionality that a blood stain expert would actually be able to get information from, they'll walk through it and they distort the shape. They also release their own secretions. So they will spit and they will also poop, which is liquid. And when they do, if they've been feeding upon the victim's tissues, then what they're going to do is they're going to deposit their own spit and poop that looks like the stains that actually are derived from the victim, in which case it can confuse a bloodstain analyst because it looks the same and it chemically is going to test the same.
Let's say flies spit and poop all over a lampshade that didn't have any blood on it. That can really change what investigators think happened here. So Rivers is looking for a way to quickly differentiate between those spots made by flies and actual blood from the victim.
We've recognized that flies have unique enzymes that they use for digestion that oftentimes are structurally different than what we would have in humans. So we designed an antibody that would be able to recognize one specific enzyme that's derived from these flies that visit a corpse. And we've got it now that if you're examining a series of stains, that some of which that you think actually contain fly contaminants, you can put the antibody on top of it. And then we use a secondary compound that when that's added will cause a color change anywhere that you actually have the fly enzyme.
David Rivers is a forensic entomologist from Loyola University, Maryland. He studies bugs and dead bodies, and right now he's testing his product to make sure that it works for as many different types of flies as possible. Oh, and one more thing. We were talking about how quickly flies get to a body, and here's what happened.
I've actually had scenarios where I've run experiments on my own campus during the summer, And because I use roadkill frequently for some of the studies, and I keep them frozen in a freezer, I've walked outside with it being frozen, and flies have landed on it before I even got to the site that I was going to put it in.
So you walk around and pick up roadkill for your experiments?
There seems to be some hesitation in your voice. Yes, I do this, and my wife is worried that I'm going to be arrested at some point because that's a difficult one to explain to a state trooper. But yes, the trunk of my car is loaded with gloves, shovels, trash bags, coolers to pick up roadkill and be able to use them for some experiments.
You're doing good work, Dave. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about gross things. One of our main defenses against all things yuck is soap. If you feel sweaty or smelly, maybe your hair is a little bit greasy, you want to step in the shower. We also wash our hands after we use the bathroom, hopefully anyway, or after we've touched stuff that we feel is disgusting or that could make us sick. Maybe you've just helped a kid blow their nose or something. But what if you think the soap itself is gross? What we consider a solid choice for cleaning ourselves up has changed a lot over time. And here's reporter Laura Spencer in Kansas City with more.
In ancient Rome, people smeared themselves with pumice or ash to clean their bodies. Then they'd layer on some oil.
But if the kids got, you know, kind of messy in the backyard, basically mom would get out some olive oil and kids would rub it over themselves and then scrape it off.
That's ancient art curator Robert Cohn. He works at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri. Rome was known for its public baths, Cohn says, but you go for a spa soak to be social. Cleanliness wasn't really the focus.
One gets the sense that there is a different attitudes towards hygiene in the ancient world than what we have today.
He says, imagine downtown Rome or downtown Pompeii a few thousand years ago.
You have dog poo, you have horse poo, you have cattle poo, all in the streets. And that stuff doesn't really get cleaned away until there's a good rainstorm, maybe.
Without soap, you can only get so clean. But the ancients who used ash and olive oil were onto something. Basic bar soap begins with animal fat or vegetable oil. You add an ingredient that both dissolves in water and cuts through grease, like ashes. Then a chemical reaction happens to make soap. But once you have the soap, what's the chemistry of getting things clean? Gunk, like dirt or germs, sticks to our hands because of the oils on our skin. Soap molecules grab onto oil particles. Then water washes the gunk away. If you use enough soap and rub your hands together for long enough, you'll have less oil and germs left on your hands. That's why public health officials are always trying to get us to wash our hands for at least 20 seconds. Plain soap doesn't kill bacteria, but microbes get flushed down the drain. But in one market survey group, about half the U.S. consumers surveyed said they think bar soap is covered with germs after you use it. It does make you wonder about that damp bar in the soap dish, marinating in a puddle of shower water. To find out if regular soap really is gross, I got in touch with the people who have been selling us soap for more than 100 years, Procter & Gamble. Think Ivory soap.
The market for bar soaps is declining.
That's chemist Froggen Neuse.
Probably about, you know, 2% over the last 5 years, but it is definitely declining.
Fresh and clean as a whistle. These days, when it comes to getting clean as a whistle, we have a lot more choices. And Neuse says, at least in North America, more people are choosing liquid soaps or body washes over bar soaps. But she says it's not really the gross-out factor that's driving down bar soap sales. It's more about personal preference and how people want to experience getting clean. I took the bar soap versus liquid soap debate to the Kansas City Folk Festival. As old and young people, some with kids, were streaming in, I did an informal survey.
Liquid, because the bar soap leaves a ring around your tub.
Liquid soap. It just makes me feel cleaner.
Liquid. Easier to get to. Just squirt and go. It seems a little bit more sanitary.
Liquid soap was the definite crowd favorite. But is liquid soap really more sanitary or cleaner than soap in a bar? There was a doctor in the house, so I asked him. Family medicine physician Alan Greiner was working at a pop-up clinic for musicians. Greiner and his staff use lots of alcohol-based hand rub at the clinic. But for the rest of us, should it be bar soap or liquid soap?
The truth is, there's probably not a real big difference.
I checked in with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but the public health officials didn't say which is more germy, bar soap or liquid soap, and they said they don't have a recommendation on which one works best at home. So just because bar soap might seem old-fashioned, is there a reason to think it's covered in germs? Again, Dr. Greiner.
You can get some bacteria that will stay on a bar of soap, but by and large, when you use that bar of soap, all those bacteria are going to be washed away with the water that's flushing things out. But I don't think there's any major reason to feel like it's icky.
For The Pulse, I'm Laura Spencer.
I'm Mike and Scott, and next on our pretty disgusting edition of The Pulse, we're going to head into a sewer. We have to. And we've done that kind of thing before. For example, chasing fatbergs.
Which is an accumulation of grease plus wet wipes and other things that get washed down that have formed massive blockages.
But a fatberg has nothing on the kinds of things Damon Hopkins has encountered in the sewers of Pittsburgh. The grossest thing he's ever seen, chest-high feces. Pittsburgh has a really old sewer system, and when there's a lot of rain, excess stormwater can overwhelm the pipes. So to keep the system running, workers from the sewer authority manually clean up the gateways between the sewer and the city's three rivers. Reporter Lou Bluen spent a day with the crew, and he sent us this audio postcard.
We're going to go down here a little piece and hose out real quick.
My name is Charles Simone. I'm a supervisor on regional conveyance for Alcosan. It's amazing some of the things you find in a store that you wouldn't think would be in there besides the normal waste products. During a heavy rain event, we will get a lot of weeds, rocks, tires, railroad ties, trees, anything that you would think would be in a store that shouldn't be in a store does come into this store.
Hey, Daryl, what were you just looking at?
Rat's carcass.
There was a rat carcass?
Yes. We need to get rid of that. We need a hose.
That's where we get that expression, a drowned rat. There's really one here.
So, what's the grossest thing you've ever done, Charles?
Well, when I first came out here, I was working on the crew trucks. And they said, we got to go down there and pull that rack. Well, I really didn't have an understanding of what pulling the rack was. And in certain structures, we have these racks that are like a metal grating with fingers on them. And it would collect all the rags, the tampons, the condoms, and the rats, and any debris. So I was down there pulling the rack one day, and I'm struggling pulling it off. And all of a sudden, it broke free, and a big condom slapped me right in the face. So, I mean, it is a gross, gross job. So you wash properly, and hopefully your wife or girlfriend still wants to talk to you after you tell them that joke.
I am Shonda Kelly. I work at Alcosan as a vacuum truck operator. It's like your garden hose with high pressure, and it's like a shop vac with high pressure.
So I got to ask you, you're with a bunch of guys out here. You're the only gal, is that right?
I'm the only one.
So what's it like to be the only woman working on a crew with, a bunch of guys doing what a lot of people consider man's work, you know what I mean?
They're wimps. I tend to find that I am less afraid of the bugs and animals and the dirt than they are. But you learn to shop talk right with them, I guess, and give it right back.
They seem to have a lot of respect for you, though.
Yeah, because they know that I'll work right with them. I'm not a prissy girl that's not going to get dirty.
So who's drawn the short straw today to have to go in the hole?
I'm not sure yet. We try to let the crew figure it out who wants to go down and perform that duty.
So you got to go down in that hole?
Yes, I do. I'm looking forward to it.
Why do they send the biggest guy down in the smallest hole?
I don't know. Who's going to hold my wallet? Yeah, listen to that.
There's nothing in it. You ain't getting it.
It's going down with me. It's going down with me. Down with the ship.
Bring Mike in here. Feel like an unsung hero at times doing this work?
Very much so. It's a very underappreciated task. You know, people, they don't like the equipment in their way. And once we get started, a lot of times, they certainly don't like the smell. But if these lines aren't clean, if we don't keep these structures hosed out, everything's going to be backing up. Sewage backing up into their basements or businesses. So all this is underground for the most part. You know, so it's not paid attention to. People take it for granted. But it's something that needs to be done to make the waters better for everybody to use.
All right, when you're ready.
Some of the men and women who clean up Pittsburgh's sewers, the voices of Mike Altimore, Donnie Smith, Shonda Kelly, Daryl Smith, and crew supervisor Charles Simone. Lou Bluin originally produced this story for the public radio program The Allegheny Front, which airs on WESA in Pittsburgh. Before we go, remember the disgust researcher we met earlier, psychologist David Pizarro? He studies why we feel grossed out and how that changes from person to person. Of course, I did have to ask him what grosses him out, and I thought his answer was pretty funny.
So many things. There's a disgust sensitivity questionnaire, and it asks questions like, imagine that you take a sip from a soda and you realize that it wasn't yours, it was a stranger's. That disgusts me. I'm topping out at disgust for that. Imagine that you're walking down a train tunnel and you smell urine. That disgusts me pretty easily. So I could go on and on, but
wow.
I think suffice it to say I'm pretty easily disgusted.
You're not made for city living.
You know, I have to tell you, I can't even run my own studies sometimes. I have to have my graduate students do it. Because I can't stand to look at, there's a standard database of pictures that we often use. A lot of these are disgust pictures. I can't even look through those. When I give talks on disgust, I have to use the same pictures over and over again because I got used to those pictures. But looking at the other ones just, it makes me faint in the head.
All right, what's the worst? What's the worst picture? Come on.
For some reason, maggots. Seeing maggots, and I do not know why. But the sight of maggots can just leave me not able to eat. Now, thank you. You know, now I'm not going to be able to eat for the rest of the day.
Oh, I'm sorry. But maggots are clean. Maggots are clean. That's what they
maggots are. They are clean. I think they're just eating very dirty things.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. And this week, we welcome our new innovations reporter, Alan Yu, to the team. We're really excited to have him here. We had production help this week from Joel Wolfram and Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Tanya English is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott, thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse.
Any recent hospitalizations?
We accompany a family to their first health exam in America. They've just arrived from Syria.
Do you have any other concerns about him?
A look at refugees and refugee health. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Lancaster General Health proudly supports WHYY. Lancaster General Health has joined Penn Medicine to bring patients in the Lancaster region access to advanced medical research and progressive clinical trials. Through close collaboration and the use of innovative technologies, Lancaster General Health is bringing the knowledge and experience of Penn Medicine from Philadelphia to you. More information is available at lghealth.org/pennmedicine.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.